Born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era, it's Resonance Rewind, sharing lessons from the creatives of yesteryear for the population of today.
Observer from his own time, who appears in the form of a hologram that only Sam can see and hear. And so Dr. Beckett finds himself leaping from life to life, striving to put right what once went wrong, and hoping each time that his next leap will be the leap home.
Which I'll probably say, oh boy, or oh, maybe not. Certainly, the first leap takes us back into the 1950s. We are analysing Quantum Leap, the original version from the 1980s. Of course, the latest incarnation does follow on from this in so many ways. It's recently re-emerged on Paramount Plus as a key element. But ultimately, this was something that was created and produced by the Belisarius stable. and indeed opens up a whole range of activities for the viewer to actually experience through, of course, the traveling Sam Beckett, literally leaping through time together with his faithful friend Al Calavici, as we find out. But let's find out what indeed our team make of this quantum leap as we head into the whole world of the whole systems. Let's start off with Jared Palmer. Jared, your thoughts on Genesis, part one, of course, of the original Quantum Leap series.
I thought it was a very interesting series, actually. I hadn't heard of Quantum Leap before, so that I was pretty. It's a pretty much new experience for me. And of course, I know about Scott from Star Trek Enterprise, so it was interesting to see him in, outside of that role. I was a bit confused about what was going on to begin with, despite the bit of the introduction and the bit of the way that Sam sort of interacts with the world and stuff like that. But I think for me, I did enjoy it, but it took me a bit longer for me to sort of like understand what was going on in the episode compared to the other things we've covered.
Well, I'm not sure whether we're going to have impacts of Quantum Leap heading into Jessica Bertis land. I believe you're saying that you've got challenges with your audio, Jessica. Perhaps if we unmute yourself, hopefully all will be well. And as actually it's the Bertis family household who are singularly responsible for us actually looking at Quantum Leap, I think it's only fair that you actually relay your own thoughts on this. Is this the first time you've actually seen the original episode?
This isn't the first time I've seen it, and I wish I could remember my very initial opinions about this episode, because I remember I was just enamored by it after maybe 20 minutes, and I knew I wanted to keep watching this season, and luckily my mom also was happy to binge it and feel nostalgic around the show because she loves it, and it was still fun to rewatch it. I think I had remembered more apparently about the part one, the pilot part, than I had about the baseball part. I think some of the other episodes are a bit more memorable, but I do think that the whole X2 pilot part is pretty cool. I think that it's a good action-packed, high-stakes first episode. And I think it's a bit different from the rest, but I think it's a very good pilot, in my opinion.
Yeah, so directed by David Hemmings, who's certainly got a wealth of credits to his name, and written, of course, by Donald P. Belisario. Connection, of course, with Residence Rewind team, of course, is the Donald Belisario, who is also responsible for Airwolf, amongst other things, with, of course, our very own Gene Bruce Scott in the lead role there. The start, I think, is quite interesting because, of course, we are introduced basically to somebody who seems to have a very high libido or possibly be on the borderline of sexist territory. And when we talk about Dean Stockwell's incarnation as Rear Admiral Albert Al Calavici and the way in which, obviously, he picks up a stranded female motorist and then effectively heads off, presumably for what he believes is going to be a completely different experience to where he ends up going, when, of course, we find out that Gushy is having problems with Ziggy and Sam has actually stepped into the Quantum Leap Accelerator. Jared, did you think that actually worked as a plot device, or did it actually confuse you in terms of where we're going? Because the first time, of course, we see Sam, he has actually jumped back to the 1950s. And of course, we hear on the radio Doris Day with Que Sera Sera and the lyrics, "The future's not ours to see," are the first lines that come through.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, "What will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich?" Here's what she said to me. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. When I grew up and fell in love, I asked my sweetheart what lies ahead. Will we have rainbows day after day? Here's what my sweetheart said. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be. Now I have children of my own. They ask their mother, what will I be? Will I be handsome? Will I be rich? I tell them tenderly. Que sera, sera. Whatever will be. The future's not ours to see. Que sera, sera. What will be, que sera, sera.
I think if I hadn't watched Life on Mars, which has a similar concept, except that the character gets thrown back into the 70s instead, I think I would have been a bit more confused, but I kind of did make that connection, but I was just a bit confused about who was this character. Whereas in like, I felt like we could have had a bit more of a setup for his character before he gets thrown back in the past. But overall, I don't think it was too confusing for me, but I think it's because I've watched similar shows, so I was able to connect the dots there. But I'm not sure about whether anyone else would have the same issues, though.
In many ways, you could argue that this was a pioneer at a time where actually that non-linear form of storytelling was probably restricted to some avant-garde filmmakers. So having a Swiss cheese memory where you can only remember parts of the whole system can be quite challenging. Jessica, again, focusing just on part one as we're doing this week, did you feel that, again, the narrative, as you said, kind of moved along at quite a pace? Did you feel actually that the music, obviously we have Elvis Presley and Hound Dog when Sam's, or rather Sam's character's partner, Bird Dog, sort of sets about his whole thing, played by John Alan Nelson, Captain Bill Bird Dog Burdell. Again, it's difficult to actually, because none of us were actually around at the time, but did you feel it managed to capture the era of the late 1950s and, of course, the onset of the men with the right stuff who would actually be taking those first steps in terms of supersonic travel, which would ultimately lead to the space program?
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, you're crying all the time. You ain't looking but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine. Well, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, they said you was high class. Well, that was just a lie. Yeah, you ain't never caught a rabbit, and you ain't no friend of mine. You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
that the having that 1950s setting was pretty cool for the pilot of a time travel show, because I think when I think of the 1950s, I do think of very interesting period in science where people were kind of pushing the boundaries in terms of space exploration and things like that. So it feels like a very experimental time in terms of science. And I feel like that matches the whole pilot of the X2 very well. That's so risky that, you know, the original pilot didn't survive the flight. And now Sam has to figure it out, even though he's not a pilot with his little guardian angel watching over him. And I think that choosing the 50s was probably one of the best settings that they could have done, in my opinion, because it's far enough in the past that people don't have as much memory of it. Well, I guess back then I would have, but now I think it's a cool setting because it would have been familiar enough, but also it's not, you know, just 2 years ago or something like that. Although I do think that the show tends to stick with just the 1900s as it goes on. It would have been cooler if they had chosen, I don't know, just, you know, like a medieval period or something a bit more diverse periods. But I think that the 50s is still a very iconic time period.
Very interesting, because the catch of the series, of course, and as Al Calavici actually explains to Sam with the benefit of a holographic piece of string, is that Sam can only time travel within his own lifetime. So that's the limit. There is actually one episode where he does actually go beyond that, but in the main, it's very much a case of it's only within his own lifetime. Hence the agony he finds when he can't remember his father's telephone number, and he talks about area codes and all sorts of other areas within that. He remembers the telephone number of his research station, but there are a number of times there where I think the melancholy that Scott Bakula actually gives to the character of Sam Beckett, somebody who, again, pushing the boundaries of science, which in a year which has seen certainly Oppenheimer emerge triumphant at the box office, we go back to the whole experience of the atomic bomb, the comet is actually made, that the quantum leap experiment is taking place in the same location as the atomic bomb was actually being tested and built and produced from that point of view, which of course fundamentally is all based on Einstein's time and relative dimensional aspects that he puts into play when he starts talking about quanta and quantum, etc. That's how the science was behind it. So again, mixing and matching a lot of things there, including the potential rashness of scientists, because Beckett obviously jumping straight in there without necessarily checking all the safety things. And of course, as far as we know, he's still out there, even with the new series that's actually opened up. There's still that whole thing that they're hunting for him, and somehow, you know, he can't be found. Or maybe he's being pulled around by a higher power. What do you say, Jared?
I would say at the moment it is something that I was thinking of, that either something was interfering with the system, or that he's being like sent back into the past because someone higher up, or like some sort of organization, just want him either out of the way, or they want him to find something. So I feel as if it's a bit like Source Code, the film that Jake Gyllenhaal starred, where he was sent back into the past, and then he has to either find out what he needs to do to stop it, to prevent it. But unlike the film, it actually can change history, whereas in Source Code, it can't. So it's an interesting to see where the parallels between those two medias come from. But I think for the moment, there does appear like there is a bigger end game at the moment from what I've watched.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Source Code, because when I first saw that in the sort of, I felt, this is Quantum Leap, but just for a different sort of angle, that so it goes. In Britain, we, I think, used to have Quantum Leap screened on BBC Two at 9 p.m. on a Tuesday evening, if memory serves. It may not, of course, because obviously things can vary in terms of how we're working on that basis. What about memorable moments, though, Jessica, from part one at least?
I think to me, there are so many memorable moments, but I think one of them is when he realizes that he doesn't remember his father's name, so he can't actually call him, and how heartbreaking that is that he wanted to. But I think also him saving his child. He saved not one life, but two lives going back in time. And used his medical knowledge to help the baby and Peg. So well, I
you're
think
absolutely
that
right, of course, Jessica, but that is part two. So technically it doesn't qualify for our part one.
Oh, part I forget we're doing week. Part one.
You're doing the old best of both worlds routine and actually jumping ahead of time and then jumping back into it again.
I spoiled
it's okay.
it. I'm sorry. I think that having Alan Sam and, you know, I think that also just seeing him with a different person's face is always entertaining. I think it's funny whenever he gets to see what he looks like. But yeah, having Al try to step in. And I think that also just the first moments of any time he's within the new setting is really, I don't know, it's really cool, because then it's to me, I guess, because I already know the plot of the show, it wasn't really that confusing, so it kind of immediately was excited to jump back into it while he's jumping back in time. So I think that those initial moments of him being back in that period are really fun to me, but maybe that's again because I've seen it. But yeah,
I mean, again, it is one of those areas where, as we know, that Al is the hologram. And he's in an imaging chamber, and when Sam Beckett has jumped into another person's body and existence, that other person's consciousness is effectively also located in the image generator and so on, which is how the whole system works. And again, that opening sort of moment of horror, really, in essence, where Sam kind of looks at himself in the mirror and gets a shock, and obviously, well, in fact, before then, when he wakes up and finds that effectively he's got a total stranger next to him, who's obviously very pregnant, and he has no idea what he's doing there at all, effectively, which possibly foreshadows, again, challenges that folk who are suffering from Alzheimer's often have in terms of the way in which memory can go, so I believe, et cetera. And it is one of those areas which shows perhaps the fragility of life as well. Maybe just like a hologram, that somehow it's so ephemeral, you can literally walk through it, whether you're on a fishing trip or whatever. Jared, memorable moments for yourself?
I would say for me, I would say it was probably the bit where he realizes he's someone else, because I often do find that from a cinematic point of view and a cinematography, a very hard thing to do, because you're playing with mirrors here. And the problem is, when you use a lot of mirrors, the crew, sometimes if you don't do it well, you can see the crew or see a member of the staff in the background. But I think for this one, it's quite interesting how they were able to edit it for its time, because I think the effect still holds up, and I couldn't see like the cameraman or the boom mic operator. So I think that one was very well. And I also did like the bit in the medical part where he's explaining how to save, I think it's Tom, the person he's pretending he thinks it, who everyone else thinks he is, his wife. And I think it's interesting to see where his actual knowledge comes in. And yeah, I think for those are my favorite two moments of that.
Interesting.
Episode.
David Hemmings, of course, a director for this one, was also featured in Gladiator, Barbarella, a Blow Up, a whole variety of other things. He was an actor who obviously then went temporarily in terms of directing from that perspective. Well, let's talk characters, of course. I mean, we could also mention the music, which, again, I think carries us along very positively in terms of the kind of messages that come through it. But what about your favourite characters, Jessica?
Okay, I managed to find a mute button. I think Al,
are you in an imaging chamber, Jessica?
I think so. I am a hologram right now. So I'm watching over everything. I think Al is my favorite character. I think he's just entertaining. And I think that he has a bit of a more quiet presence than Sam. And he has that, like I said, the guardian angel kind of feeling toward about him. And I think that just the way that they interact is really interesting to me. I think that they balance each other pretty well. They're both, I'd say, fairly intelligent people, but I think Sam tends to be a bit more panicky, which understandably, because he's thrown into the past and he might die in a plane. So I think that he tends to be a bit more high-strung and Al's a bit more calm. And I think that his presence is always very welcome in the show. I really liked Peggy too. So I think that she's a very sweet, and I think she's also a character who seems to know herself. A dishonorable mention would be his co-pilot. but yeah.
You're not a fan of Bird Dog Burdell, basically, and his propensity for obviously seeking out females like a bird dog would do from that point of view. Not the best way forward, certainly not for contemporary themes at least.
No, but Sam's a very honorable guy, so...
So Jennifer Runyon played Peggy Stratton. Just for completeness, we mentioned the music, of course, Mike Post responsible for the theme. Mike Post, of course, is also responsible for such memorable lines as the A-Team, as well as the Greatest American Heroes. And I believe Hill Street Blues was also a Mike Post number. So lots of kind of history from that point of view. Favorite characters for yourself, Jared?
I would have to say it was Al, just because of how funny he was and how much times like you get Sam like winded up out of everything. It was like... And I kind of did find it very funny, though. And at the same time, I was like, yeah, this is going to continue for the rest of the series, isn't it? So I really did enjoy his character. I think overall, he kind of overdid it as the, I would say the hidden hero in the actual episode. But it was still quite funny to see him as a comic relief as well. So...
Of course, the show would actually go on in its original incarnation for 5 seasons. There'd be 97 episodes made. And mini-spoiler, actually, Rear Admiral Albert Al Calavici has his own demons and spectres that effectively he needs to be sorted out from that point of view, which, again, is quite interesting. The final episode, which I'm sure we'll look at sometime in Residence Rewind, The Leap Home, is probably one of the most heart-wrenching moments of final closure. For the first series, at least, that we can recall. Okay, so Genesis Part 1, September 13th, 1956, to give it its full title. Any other aspects you'd like to raise, Jessica, that you think, yeah, before we start moving on to scores, etc., are worth talking about? Because we have quite an ensemble cast here, really, with not only, as you mentioned, Jennifer Runyon playing Peggy Stratton, we obviously mentioned John Allen Nelson as Captain Bill Burdog Burdell, but we have, you know, a fair number of other fair. We have the wives, of course, of the astronauts and their fears and concerns. And I think they also managed to capture perhaps the uncertainty and fear that these people were going off to work and there was no guarantee that they'd come back alive, basically.
Yeah, I think that something that this show does pretty well is it highlights smaller things, I think, that were happening in time periods in the 1900s that might be overshadowed by other things while still tying them in. Like how you mentioned that they were talking about the atomic bomb and just all the things that were going on at that time. I don't think that I would think of experimental plane pilots as one of the things of that period, but these are still really important formative things that happened. And I like that it highlights those kind of smaller things, the everyday things. And I think that I also love having Sam as a protagonist for this show, because I think there's often this I don't know, this scientist trope that we get where they're very aged and wise and they're very present of mind, or they're very young and suave and still know everything and they're very arrogant and rich. But I think that Sam is the really interesting, he's just so different from those tropes, where he's just very wholesome and he's a bit bumbling and he's high strung and he's really confused and he's still capable. And I think that that's really nice to see in a protagonist, because I think coming off of things like Star Trek, where we have Picard and we have Captain, where very confident people, I think Sam is the very opposite of that. He's really things out as he goes, and I think that that's nice, especially for a show when it might be confusing the first time and viewers are also trying to figure things out as they go. So I think that that was a good choice, in my opinion, for them to have as our eyes into this world.
This is particularly interesting when we get around to actually looking at Enterprise, when we see Scott Bakula portray Captain Jonathan Archer. There is also a nice, interesting echo of the relationship between his father and himself in terms of that, certainly in the opening episode, Broken Bow. And in addition to that, of course, we have the line here that, looking ahead slightly to next week, really, we see Sam as somebody who's obviously, his father was a farmer. He's growing up on a farm. He knows how to milk a cow. We also find out he's got, you know, not one, not two, but 6 scientific degrees in all sorts of things, as well as a medical one. So, you know, clearly he's advanced from that. But then we also see, as the series develops, that maybe that was also tied in with the fact that he was always trying to impress as the younger sibling from his brother as well. So lots of other areas that I think were woven into the series without necessarily a story arc, because each episode is, broadly speaking, standalone, with a few two-parters thrown in there, and indeed the whole notion of the cliffhanger ending or the cliffhanger leap. But again, it worked on that premise. Okay, Jared, what would be your score for this particular episode, the first one in the Quantum Leap saga, part one, September 13th, 1956?
I would have to give it a 7 because I think overall the episode was really good. I the cinematography and the way that they structured the episode. I would have liked it if maybe they made it a bit more clear from to establish Sam as the character a bit before they threw him back in time. But I think ultimately the episode was very enjoyable. I enjoyed it, and I'm looking forward to watching more episodes.
Well, we'll certainly be looking at part two next week, as I say. Interesting, of course, they utilise the title Genesis, not only for presumably its biblical references in terms of the beginning, and you could say that Sam had a huge fall, and in terms of that fall, he was falling through time, which again ties in with that. But you could also say another cross-reference with Star Trek, and of course the Genesis device from Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, and many other subsequent incarnations. I'm probably going to go for infinity here, i.e. 8, because, again, I think it's not a perfect opener, but I do feel it certainly repays repeated watching. And when you do actually watch it again, you often sort of pick up on a number of the nuances. For instance, Howdy Doody, the Howdy Doody show, and the clips from that point of view, which, again, none of us were around at the original time, but was very much a classic of American children's television. And the way that was sort of being percolated through the whole thing. And even the thing which initially I thought, I'm not sure about that. It sounds as though when the aircraft pilot is in the machine that crashes, that there's coffee percolating. Of course, we know the reason that it's not coffee that's percolating. It's something else completely different. But there was very much a sound, the bubbles that were coming through there. I thought, what on earth have they actually put the sound of a coffee percolator going off in the background there? But again, that was a nice sort of thing which I think looks ahead to episode two. Jessica, this was your choice. What are you going to go for your particular score for the episode?
For me, I would give it a 9.5. I think that it's not my favorite episode in the series, but I do think it's a really good, solid one. And I do think, as much as I like the title Genesis, they did kind of miss out on using pilot for the pilot. I think that it would have been a really good use here. It would have been well suited. I think it's a great episode. I think it's a great series, and it's one I do prefer this original to the newer one. As good as the new one is, I think that it is the old one. I don't know, there's just a quality to it with, I think, also the way that it's shot and the film that's used that just makes it feel a bit nostalgic. And I think that suits a time travel show very well. My mom gives this an 8.5. So a little bit lower than me, but she thinks that this episode is not so memorable, but the series itself is just excellent.
Yeah, and it's interesting looking at the contemporary version, which probably someday we might actually look at from that point of view, that it is slick. It is put together. It does have lots of nods and homages to the original incarnation. It's into its second season, so it's clearly finding a kind of audience. But yeah, in a certain sense, there was something that was magical about the chemistry between Al and Sam Beckett. I mean, again, the fishing sequence that we actually have was all part of that. I think they had to use the classic cliche, a chemistry that really sort of worked in this particular show. And at a time where clearly we're at the end of the 80s, we're at the end of the Reagan, the Berlin Wall is literally just falling, and changes are afoot across Europe in general. So I think it pays dividends for that. And of course, it gives you some interesting insights in terms of travel through history as well. Just briefly, Jessica, in terms of other time travel things that we've looked at, and obviously we've looked at a fair number of them now, including Doctor Who, arguably, but also the essence of the time tunnel, which was how do you think it compares with those sort of notions of the way in which time is adjusted and played around with?
I do think that this one has a, I guess, a smaller, narrower focus than some of the other ones. I think that even though they all involve some crisis of some sort, I think having just Sam and Al being the two that you really see involved in the time travel does keep things feeling a bit smaller. And I think that some of the other time travel programs we've looked at, it was kind of a team going back in time. A team of agents, and they were doing it on purpose, which I do think is often the difference. So I think this whole idea of somebody getting sucked back into time, and now they just have to deal with the fallout and not only try to get back to their own time, but they're having to repair other things to get back there first. Whereas I feel like in the other ones, it was kind of, the ramifications of this are what we're going back to fix.
Indeed.
And in this one, it was kind of, well, if you want to get, sorry.
No, carry on.
I was just going to say in this one, you know, it isn't just, oh, the consequences need to be fixed. It's if you want to go home at all, you don't have a choice. So it feels like Sam's really thrown into a lot, which I think makes the time travel feel very demanding in this one. And I think it feels very transactional, and I like that.
Although it could be said that Irwin Allen did actually prefigure this with the time tunnel. Because Tony and Doug, of course, never quite managed to make it home either. And arguably, we had a similar trigger point because it was Doug Phillips followed by Tony Newman who effectively proved that the device actually would work by going back in time, and he ended up in the Titanic or on the Titanic. So, you know, that maybe there are sort of similarities that were drawn here. Although I take your point, Jessica, that a lot of the successful stories in this, with a few exceptions, because I think there's one case where Sam leaps into Lee Harvey Oswald just as he's about to actually pull the trigger, allegedly, on President Kennedy. There are lots of other areas that are small-scale stories as far as history is concerned, but large-scale events as far as individuals are concerned. And maybe that's a slightly more human approach to the whole thing. So next week, part two. And Jessica can obviously wax lyrical on whether that also is scoring 9.5, etc., where indeed we see the next stage of Sam's leap, proving that he does successfully come to the end of his jockey period and moves into a baseball period, which again is symptomatic of a very emblematic American way of life. For the moment, though, we wish hopefully Anna Costa-Gonnell all the best. She was apparently evacuated because of a fire alarm, which is the reason she couldn't join us from that point of view. I think Pamela Suman might be back with us next week. But for now, to Jared Palmer, to Jessica Burtis, a huge thanks. And I suppose we probably have to say those immortal words keep on resonating, but I'll probably say something more quantum leapy, such as, oh boy.
So green and still, more than the mulberries on the hill, more than the buds on the May apple tree, I love thee. Arms have I, strong as the oak, for this occasion, lips have I to kiss thee too in friendly persuasion. Thee is mine, though I don't know many words of praise. Thee pleasures me in a hundred ways. Put on your bonnet, your cape, and your glove, and come with me. For thee I love. Thank you.
Given enough time, you can get used to anything, even a nightmare. All you have to do is relax and trust those around you.
When did you get into the import business?
What are you talking about?
All that long-legged honey staying at the ranch this weekend.
What's he doing, Tom? Smell him out?
It's a natural gift, son. It's a natural gift. Sort of like a bird dog flushing quail.
Yeah, well, I gotta mount up.
You know, I'm actually beginning to enjoy this. I mean, here I am, a daring Air Force test pilot who doesn't have to fly.
Well, she's all yours, Bart. Take her up to 25 while I answer Mother Nature.
Mother Hen, Edwards, radar indicates you are in a 40 degree per minute turn to the right. Are you experiencing a problem? Over. Mother Hen, Edwards, do you have a problem? Over.
Edwards, this is Mother Hen. We must have had a bubble in the hydraulic system, because for a while this bird was flying like a Mack truck. Whatever it was, we must have burped it out. We are continuing our climb up to 25,000. Now, you save it for Weird Ernie, Bard. You ain't never gonna sucker me. Just don't ask me to fly.
Edwards, Mother Hen, level at 25,000.
Roger, Mother Hen, you are clear to drop.
Hey, Tony, I'm tired of hauling your butt around. I'm gonna cut you loose and see which of us gets back to that blonde first.
Is everybody back there okay where they're at?
Yeah, looks fine to me. All right, 240 indicated. Here we go, ladies. Drop in 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Bombs away.
Accelerating. Nosing over. 1.9, Mach 2. All right, she's leveling off. 65,000. 66. Level at 71,000. Mach 2.4. On profile. Alright, starting my run. Firing rocket 3. Mach 2.5. 2.6. Outside skin temperature 6, 8, 3. Ain't no fire warning light. Guess we beat that gremlin. Mach 2.7. 2.8. Skin temperature 800. Fire warning light. Rockets off. Everything looks okay. Mach 2.4. 2.3. Nah, I think it's another false alarm. Hey, where are you, Dougie?
5 miles behind you at 30,000.
Roger. Coming back to you for a look-see. Don't turn above Mach 2. Don't turn above Mach 2. Oh, I lost it!